I'm extremely happy to be here in Lianaping, especially in this most beautiful temple. I think there's already so much blessing here that the great masters like His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Trungpa Rinpoche and many others already blessed this. And on top of that, you have done, so many of you have done 3 years retreat. And I have I'm very happy to start the Siddha kind of teachings this year again in Lianaping, the Rigpa Siddha in the West. Many of you have been studying Dharma for a long time, and so I'm sure there's not much that I can say which you do not know already. But I'll be happy to go through the text. And maybe because this is not a very long text, so if I'll probably give a lot of time for discussion, for asking questions and things like that. And this is a small, short teaching by Pattu Rinpoche on the instructions on the view of the Mahayana, clarifying the two truths. I don't think there is any need to say anything more about Pattu Rinpoche, because you have been studying lots of things about Pattu Rinpoche. As you know, he was one of the most learned lamas not only that he was a great master, a great yogi, highly realized being, the main holder of the Dzogchen lineage, but he was also a great scholar. I think you know the story that Jamyang Chenzi the Great, Jamgo Kongtrul the Great, and Pattu Rinpoche, all three greatest masters of that time, studied under the great Pandita, Shechen Pandita we call him, the great master from Shechen, Shechen Wentul. And later on, when Jamyang Chenzi Wangpo was asked, among three of you, who is the most kind of a learned person? Because all three of you are so great. And that time he said that as far as learning or scholarship is concerned, there is no doubt Pattu Rinpoche is the best. So, this is written by Pattu Rinpoche. And when we talk about the true truths, although there is no need to have much introduction, maybe I would just say that generally speaking, all Buddhist teachings are kind of geared towards how to free from suffering and how to bring the lasting peace and happiness to all the beings. And generally, every one of us is trying to do that. But most of us believe that to have happiness is dependent on things, events, and situations that's around us. I have to have the everything that I want. there should not be any negative things happening. You know, everybody around me should be very kind and nice and, you know, good to me. And if everything is okay, then I will be very happy. And otherwise not. And here lies the problem. Because it's not very often that we find like that. And then it's not often that we are very happy. And even if it's a little bit like that, then we fear it will change. And then, of course, it will change also. So therefore, it is not really possible to have that situation. And even if a little bit possible sometimes, it is not possible to maintain that, because it's not possible to control everything. And because of that way of thinking, I think we become control freaks. Yeah. Many of us are control freaks, you know, we want to control everything. So therefore, there should be another way, and that another way is that what about transforming our own way of reacting to things, seeing things, and therefore how we react. So this is the inner transformation. So all, I think it should be all. What we call spiritual or kind of inner trainings of all different systems are about how can we change or transform our way of seeing things, reacting to things, and experiencing ourselves, so that, you know, that transformation takes place within us. It's not that we change everything, but we change our own way of seeing things, and thereby our way of relating to things. And through that, we transform. So therefore, it becomes very important when we study Buddhism, how we see things. How I look at things and in what way I see everything and how I see myself becomes extremely important, because there lies how I would react and how I would, you know, I would feel. If I can find the right way of looking, the right way of seeing, this is the general understanding and kind of Buddhist way of seeing, that I could be free from any kind of problems and sufferings and pain. So therefore, you know, lots of discussion, lots of teachings, lots of reflections are done on, you know, trying to find out what's the nature of the phenomena, what's the nature of myself, my mind, and what are the really, how the things really are. In Buddhism, there is not much discussion, or there is not much question about why things started, or, you know, what was the beginning of things. These are not there, because it's not the question. The question is what the things are. So therefore, it begins, for those who wish to attain liberation, there is both, one, the teaching on what is to be realized, and two, the teaching on how to put this into practice. So this is a very important point here. You know, there are two things. To understanding how the things are, or what the things are, or how to practice, or how to meditate, or how to see things. That's one thing. But then, once you have an idea about, you know, what the things are, or how the things are, and have a kind of a, what can you say, concept or understanding, that's not all, that's not enough. Because just having an understanding doesn't change our way of reacting. Having an understanding is very important, but it's not enough. That needs to be practiced. Actualized. And this is the hard part of the whole practice. Sometimes we call it meditation, practice, whatever. So therefore, you know, the study becomes important. That's why, you know, in Buddhism, study is regarded as very important because we have to understand, we have to know. We have to have to clear the doubts, understand it, not just understand it by accepting somebody's opinion, but also from our own investigation to find out. And then that, then we exercise, use it, practice it, implement it on our own life, in everyday life, and then, you know, become kind of one with it. We start to actually react with this understanding. So these three together is actually sometimes called the study. Because study sometimes includes hearing or listening, reflection and meditation. So when people go to Sheda, actually it's not only the first one, it's all three. Sheda is supposed to do three things: listening, reflection, and meditation. Listening is very important. It gives the word also listening, because listening what the experience of the Buddhas, what the experience of the great masters, how they understand it, how they see. We need to listen with not only open ear, but open heart. And it is not easy, because you know, we have a very rigid way of looking at things. And we only agree with what we already know. I think I said this many times before, so you must have heard it, but many times when I give talks, and then people come up and says, "Oh, your talk was great. It's exactly as I think." The reason why my talk was great was not because it's it's reasonable or it's according to the, whatever, nothing. It's the only reason is I agree with you. And it's like that. That's how we function. Yeah? And we sometimes even don't realize, when I say, "Oh, what you said is really good, because that's what I think." my thinking is the only, reason that what you say is great. So therefore, and if you don't agree with what I say, it is useless. And so therefore, it's very important how we listen. But that's why it is said that listening, that is one thing only. That's not to say that you just stop there, you understand what is said, but that is the first step. And a very important step, but first step. Then you investigate. But you can't investigate before you actually understand what the other people are saying. So the investigation has to take place after you really understand what is being said. So that first step is the most important thing. And sometimes we start to investigate before we understand what's all about. And then it is upside down. So this is extremely important. We cannot criticize. We cannot do a critical study of something unless we first fully and deeply understand. And this sometimes I feel is very difficult, because I see in many universities and things like that, people start to criticize before they know nothing about something. You know, how can I criticize about something when I know nothing about that? So this kind of, you know, step is, I think, extremely important. And this is very much, you know, emphasized again and again in Buddhist teachings. And this is something we have to keep in mind. Then comes the meditation, and this meditation is about using that understanding again and again in our life, in our, you know, way of living, reacting, you know, in day-to-day, you know, experience. And through that, then, you know, this understanding doesn't become something on a shelf or in our notebook, but something useful and, you know, practical in our life. And the more we use that, the more it becomes useful, because then we actually come to know how to use it, and then becomes more experiential. So now the teaching on what is to be realized. In this, there are two topics: the natural condition of all knowable phenomena in general, and two, the natural condition of one's own mind. Now this is, you know, Shija we call it Shija. Shija is what the object of knowledge, or object of our mind, you can say. What can be understood or experienced. She, the word she means no. Sha means object of knowledge, or, you know, anything that is experienceable, that is knowable, you know, that is conceivable. That's Sheja. So Sheja is a big word. It includes all things that's possible and all things that's impossible too. All things that's existing, all things that's not existing, because all things that not existing also I can think about them. You know, anything that I can think about is a Sheja. Yeah. So the word here used in English translation is knowable phenomena. I think it's a good translation, no? I think so. He's such a great translator, this Adam. Knowable phenomena. And then, and what that knows it, that means our mind. You know? Now this is very interesting because, you know, we are putting it from an experiential point of view. And this is very important because this is the Buddhist approach of looking at the things, where mind is more important than matter in a way. Because, you know, from the experience point of view, there is nothing that I can experience which can be beyond my mind, no? Anything that I, you know, or that anybody sees or hears or, you know, understands or thinks or whatever, has to be within the experience of a mind. There cannot be anything outside of an experience of somebody. Even if we say, mind is nothing, there's no mind. Mind is just a product of matter. Even if I decide like that, who is saying that? Mind. No? Mind is saying that there's mind is not there. So therefore, you know, it cannot be anybody who, you know, no experience can be without some experience. So therefore, it's from that point of view. Sometimes we try to analyze things, like in a scientific way. We try to analyze things. And then when we're analyzing, we kind of seem to forget that there is a awareness or consciousness of mind who is involved in analyzing things. And then we say, this is really objective, because the machine says so. But who is interpreting the machine? Our mind. No? So therefore, you know, this is the Buddhist way of kind of understanding, putting how we present things. So, there's looking at the phenomena, everything, all the knowable phenomena, and that knowing thing, which we call mind. And that, the natural condition of all knowable phenomena, this is also divided into two aspects, the relative and the absolute. Now these are what you call as the two truths. Two truths. The two truths are translated as the relative and the absolute. The Tibetan word for the relative is kunzop. Which has, you know, kun is all, and zop is like a little bit untrue, unreal. You know, zop is like a little bit like How do you translate Job? Fake. A little bit like a fake, or sometimes a mask is also called Job. Something it is not truly real, true. That's the kunzob, meaning of the word kunzob. And of course, tantam is the way it is. You know, how the things really are. So, sometimes these two are presented as the way things appear and the way the things really are. But then it's explained here. I sometimes feel the relative is very, very good word. Relative is a very, very good word for this. Because when you say relative, it means it's not absolute. It's relative. When some people describe the understanding of relative, relativity theory of Einstein. It's so good. It's so Buddhist, because it's same like mine. Sometimes I read some of those things, you know, that Einstein writes, and then I say, oh yes, it's so good, you know. The scientists didn't understand him very well. I'm sure that's like that, but, so therefore, you know, everything is relative means that actually, you know, I sometimes feel this true truth. I mean, it's said also at the end. So maybe I shouldn't come to the conclusion right at the beginning. But I feel that this comes to the same thing. Why not say what I feel, yeah? There's no up and down. Yeah. I think everything is very relative, meaning that you know it's very relative. I don't know whether that's really the good explanation, but you know it's so. It's dependent. Everything is very dependent, interdependent, you know. So interdependent and dependent, or dependently arising, that there is no real, real existence. So therefore, you know, to understand that everything is absolutely nothing but really relative is understanding the ultimate truth. I feel something like that, you know. If you really understand the relative nature of the whole phenomena, you understand the absolute nature, because it's so relative that there is nothing which is truly existing on its own. And that is absolute. So therefore, by understanding the relative, you understand the ultimate. And understanding the ultimate nature of things is not something separate from understanding what relative, how relative, li relative is. Does it make sense? Maybe not, doesn't matter. A philosopher should not make too much sense. Otherwise, there's nothing to debate on, you know. And then you know that if two philosophers agree, one is not a philosopher. So what Pāṭhī Rinpoche says, this is also divided into two aspects, the relative and the absolute. Now he talks about the relative aspect. Generally speaking, all appearances from those of the lowest hell of ultimate torment up to and including the post-meditation experience of bodhisattvas on the 10th bhumi are relative. All appearances, what he means is all appearances are relative. The appearances, that kind of the lowest or the deepest hell realm, ultimate torment is the name of that hell. To the highest, you know, the 10th bhumi bodhisattvas kind of the experiences of the post-meditation, not meditation, during meditation then he realizes the ultimate, but you know, as long as there is a post-meditation and meditation difference, this is generally the understanding is like this, that when somebody, you know, we try to understand the nature of phenomena, and more clearly we understand that, the nature of phenomena is, the lighter we become, you know. Lighter we become, and then we understand it quite strongly, very clearly, kind of directly, and then we are no longer in samsara. We attain the first bhumi, but then after that, still we have some, you know. You know, what you call habitual tendencies, impressions. I don't know, you can call it subconscious level experiences are there. So to kind of purify them, then you need lots of practice to do. You know. So that's the 10 bhumis. And then the idea, example given is that if you want to wash clothes, dirty clothes, you put some water and then some, what do you call it, the detergent, and then water and detergent, put it like this, a little bit like this, you know, turn it a little bit in the washing machine, majority of the dirt goes away. But there are lots of things that washing machine cannot do it, you know. You get out and you find some little things here, and, you know. Not much, but persisting, you know. And those, then you really have to, you know, use soap and, you know, effort and, you know, something to, and takes harder to get rid of them, and sometimes longer also. So that's why it says that, the 10 bhumis are all those, to get rid of these habitual tendencies. So therefore, till all these habitual tendencies are cleared, then we still have meditation and post-meditation experience. When we are in kind of meditation, and when you are not, you are kind of a little bit distracted or out of, then that's the habitual tendency can come in. Maybe at the end, a tenth bhumi may be very little, maybe we cannot really understand, but that's how it is said. So therefore, these are the relative. These are called relative. Because there is some, what can you say, some little it's not fully ultimate. There's some kind of it's pure, but still relative. Moreover, there are two kinds of relative: the incorrect relative and the correct relative. Lopi kunzu tan yanda kunzu, or pure and impure relative. Maybe pure and impure. All that we perceive before we set out on the path belongs to the category of the incorrect relative or impure relative. When we have reached the stage of aspiring conduct, it's in the note number one. And let me check what the note number one says. There's no note number one. The path of accumulation and joining. This path of accumulation is the first path. The first path of accumulation. Anyway, I don't know whether we need to go through. When our understanding becomes very clear, and really the bodhicitta becomes extremely strong, and then we enter into the kind of the second path, what we call is the journey, that time. If we can integrate some realization into our experience, it becomes the correct relative. But whenever we do not, it is the incorrect relative. Once we reach the bhumis, all that appears to the mind is the correct relative. Relative because mere appearances have not yet ceased, and correct because their falsity is seen directly. Now this is the, when we see everything, see means now here, not just see, of course. When we have all the senses, what we see and hear or any kind of experience. And when we see things and then we say, this is it. This is existing as I see. Then this is impure relative. When I see, but when I know, this what I see is like a dream, or its nature is not as it is. It doesn't have to be kind of trapped by that. Then it becomes pure relative. Now this is very important, because you know, how we see becomes very important. Just yesterday, we were talking about something, maybe the day before. You know, somebody was asking a question about, you know, if somebody, no, I was saying something like this. Maybe you also don't agree with me. I was saying like this, that if somebody says something or does something, or anybody says something or does something, whether it hurts me or not hurts me is up to me. I was saying this. And people were not feeling very good about that. And somebody was saying, you know, but I'm hurt. I'm hurt. He said, did something to hurt. I hurt. I'm hurt. So how can I? It's about how. What can I do to get rid of this hurt? Not about hurting me or not hurting me, you know? And I was saying, no. After you've hurt, then it's a little bit more difficult. I'm talking about before you are hurt, you know, that you can decide whether to be hurt or not hurt. Now there, I think it's very important. That's because whether I, you know, if somebody does something or said something or something happens or, in, you know, whatever, if I had some understanding or some way of, you know, a little bit, you know, understanding that, you know, what everybody does is not under my control, but how I react to that is up to me. You know, how I react to that is up to me. When I have that understanding, then I can choose how to react. I can choose how to react because I know that, you know, it's not useful to react in this way, but it is better to react in another way. Do you understand what I'm saying or not? Of course you would. Now this, if I had, you know, a little deeper understanding of this, for instance, that it's all relative. Everything is relative. Or everything is even impermanent, you know. Everything is impermanent, like one step before that. You know, everything is impermanent because everything changes. So therefore, you know, if it is everything is changing, and changing not in kind of 100 years, but, you know, moment by moment, then, you know, this moment, what's happening is not that important, no, to me, because it's changing next moment. So, you know, it's not that important to me. So therefore, this moment, what's happening, doesn't have to be the kind of decisive effect to make me totally, you know, like, totally, what can you say? Hopeless feeling. Yeah? If I saw this, what is happening to me, or what is something totally like so unchangeable, so bad, so everything is really like that, real and true and unchangeable and, you know, absolute, everything. The more it is seen like this, the more I feel, you know, bad about it, no? So therefore, the way, you know, the way I see things totally, you know, changes how I react to that. So therefore, the more I see things are relative, things are impermanent, then things are relative, then things are really so relative that there is no, you know, no existing of its own nature. So the more I understand that, the more I can be relaxed in reacting to things. So therefore, you know, this seeing the relative nature of things has a direct impact on how I react to what happens in my life. Like if I, you know, every one of us has this, you know, lots of things happening. Lots of things happening at the one moment. Lots of things happening around the world at this moment. And then, so therefore, you know, I have lots of different possibilities where I would allow my mind to be occupied with. So therefore, you know, if I decide or if I, you know, chose to make my mind be occupied by something really negative and painful and, you know, kind of hurting, then I feel negative and painful and hurting. And if I keep on holding to that, I cannot get out of that. And then I identify with that. This is it. I am this one. I am the one who feels miserable. Then you can never get out of it, because I'm the one who feels miserable. But if I can see that it's not that I'm the one who is feeling miserable, I have somehow made myself focus and grasp on something that is not nice and not, you know. But there, it's possible for me to make my mind occupied by other things also. And then I become, my mind becomes a little bit less, what can you say, less rigid. So therefore I also can, you know, can let other things come into my mind. And when that can happen, I can feel a little bit better also sometimes. And so, in this way, the more I can, you know, allow myself to see things in a way that everything is relative and there is no absolute, you know, reality in that. So therefore, if even something, you know, good thing happening, not good thing happening, terrible thing happening, it's kind of a, it's like that. This is like a, what yesterday was, and what last night's dream was. How much difference is there? Yesterday was real. Last night's dream was unreal. So yesterday what happened is really important. So what happened yesterday? Somebody said, you look like a dog shit. That's really terrible. You know. I will never forget it till I die. Because this said yesterday that I look like a dog shit. Yeah. So I will keep this till I die. And when I die, then also say, so as I said, I was like a dog. No? Because last night in the dream, I don't know what I dream sometimes, but somebody says, you look like a dog shit. In the morning, I wake up and I say, oh, I dreamt that somebody said I was like a dog shit. I forget, no? I have no ill feeling against that person, or I don't have any hurt feeling, anything. Why not? Because it really said it. I hear it in my ears. No? I really heard it with my own ears last night in my dream. But now I know that it was not so real. So therefore, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Even if it was really experiential. So that's why, you know, to learn that yesterday and last night's dream in many ways is not so different, you know. Then we start to learn the relative nature of things, yeah? Because it's changing. It's changing all the time, and there's no, you know, no true existence. No true existence means, I sometimes feel that the understanding of impermanence is very deep, you know. Impermanence is very deep, I think. Impermanence leads to interdependence and leads to emptiness, I think. Because when you talk about impermanence, when you think about impermanence, it means things changing. Changing, but how things changing? Things changing all the time. Yeah? And when changing? Yeah. Not once a year, no? I think I change once a year on my birthday. But it doesn't seem to be like that. Yeah. So it's not changing once a year. It's changing not once a month, not once a day, you know, not once a moment. When is the time not changing? We can find some time when things are not changing? We cannot find a time when things are not changing. And when there is no time that we can say now is not changing, that means things, there is nothing like now changing, now not changing, now changing, now not changing. No? So when there is no time, there is not changing, then it's changing all the time. It's constantly in change. So when constantly in change means it's like flowing. When constantly in change and it's like flowing, then when is it when it is existing? When is the time things are existing? Because there's no time, it's not changing. So if there is no time, the things are not changing, there can't be a time when things are existing on its own, because if it is existing on its own, it cannot change, because otherwise it cannot exist. Changing and existing cannot go at the same time of on one thing. No? Because change is transforming, and existing means kind of not changing at that moment. So when there is no time, things are not changing, there is no time when things can really be existing on its own, because if it has to exist on its own, it has to be independently there, not changing, not affected by everything, you know, not manipulated by anything. So therefore, so, when we see the impermanence clearly, we can see that everything is always changing. And therefore, because it is it changing because it's always influenced by all different elements. Yeah? All different elements are influencing it, so therefore it's changing all the time. That's why it's interdependent. It's dependent. Also because everything is changing, because it's dependent. There's nothing independent in it. So therefore everything is changing. Therefore everything is dependently arising. You look at from the whole universe down to the, you know, the tiniest atom, it's the same thing. So if that is the case, if there is no time that a thing, whether it is the universe or the atom, is existing on its own, then how is it existing? Existing in change, existing in transit. And existing in transit, it means like not existing. So therefore, that nature is emptiness. Emptiness means that. Emptiness is that everything is not existing on its own, but existing only as a transit, as a flow, in a clearly kind of a very kind of special situation, like a illusion, like a magic, like a miracle. It's very much there, but it is not existing on its own. And because it's not existing on its own, therefore all this is possible. This is, I think, important. This is the Buddhist logic, actually. That if the things were existing on its own without changing and independently, then chemistry could not be possible. chemistry is not possible because this is existing on its own, this is existing on its own, and if you put these two together, it wouldn't mix. Because this is on its own, independent. This is independent, and then this cannot affect this, and this cannot affect this. The chemistry is possible because this is not existing on its own, and this is not existing on its own. So therefore, when this put two together, this something different comes up. You know, like water. They say, you know, hydrogen and oxygen makes water. Yeah? When hydrogen and oxygen together, then a miracle happens. Water happens. Yeah? When oxygen and hydrogen are separated, there's nothing. Yeah? That's the emptiness. But that's not only water like that, everything is like that. Because everything is like that, therefore everything is possible. The whole universe is, that's why they said that it's possible to have a whole universe and a speck of dust. Because really nothing is necessary to make a universe. Because nothing exists on its own anyway, so therefore, the whole phenomena is like that, relative. It's not about how things are, but it's about how we see. So if we see the way we see it is very much to do with how I am. So if I am like a really very strongly samsaric, I am here, everything is there, and those are real there, I am really here, all those things very good and very bad, mostly very bad. Then, that's what samsara is, no? Then I see everything very kind of, real, and then, it's really nice, but then that I want it. I must have this nice thing. Nice tanka, oh yes. So nice tanka. I must have them. So if I don't have them, I wouldn't get sleep tonight. Then even that nice tanka becomes a problem for me. No? Then bad weather becomes a problem for me. That's another matter. It's okay, but even that good dhaka becomes a problem for me. Yeah? And that's the samsara. The harder I, the more strongly I see it as kind of really there, and that's really here, and then I need that to make myself happy, the more impure relative it is. But then I see this, I see it a little bit less. Actually, the lesser, that strong way of kind of true, real, permanent, out there and in here, that's way of seeing. The less I feel problematic. Sometimes, there are so many degrees, I think, and this is the key, I think, how we feel. Like sometimes, I feel this like emotional, you know, sometimes, you know, we can be very sensitive emotionally, yeah, very emotionally sensitive, you know, like you don't have to do much, you know, you just stare at me, he's looking at me, why is he staring at me? Or you say, you have a nose on your face. I say, oh, why you say I have a nose on my face? Of course I have a nose on my face. You know? I can get very angry. Yeah. You know, that's, you know, of course I have a nose. Everybody has a nose, you know. Some are bigger, some are smaller. The bigger, the better it is, no? So therefore, you know, that's why, you know, this, when we say the compassion, you know, and these things like this is good, it's because of that, you know. Sometimes I find that, you know, to be so sensitive about yourself emotionally is a very difficult thing, you know, very difficult thing. It makes you so unhappy and always, you know, in trouble. Instead, if you become sensitive about others, you know, is sensitive about sensitive intelligently or intellect, you know, I don't know whether you can say intelligently, no. Sensitive, intelligent, no. Not intellectually. How would you say? You know, you become wisely sensitive. No, that's not the right word. Yeah? Like you are aware of what's going on. Yeah? If I'm aware what's going on, what's going on in myself, what's going on others, my actions, you know, what I'm doing, what I'm saying, what I'm thinking, how is it affecting other people, you know, how other people are, you know, feeling, you know, how they are kind of affected by my actions, you know, is it good I am to be here or I am not to be here? Is it better that I talk or I don't talk? Or is it better that, you know, so if I become more sensitive of that kind, you know, I don't know how to say this, intelligently sensitive, you know. The more intelligently sensitive, I think it's better, because then I'm involved in other things, you know, in other people's, in surroundings. And then I'm not so sensitive about myself. You know. The more I'm sensitive about myself alone, you know, then I become very emotionally sensitive. Because then, you know, this person is liking me or not liking me. Yeah, this person is appreciating me or not appreciating. You know, yeah, how they like, you know, the way, you know, kind of. Then I'm always on me. So therefore, you know, even little bit like that, you know, I think. How strong I, you know, see things so solidly, so, like, if I only on me, then I'm much more emotionally affected. If my attention is more on, more broadly and what's surrounding, that makes it a little bit better. Then if my attention or emotion is more widely, makes us a little bit. Then if I see everything changing momentarily, a little bit better. If then see everything is really relative, then a little bit better. Then if I see that everything is a little bit like a dream, then even a little bit more better. Then if I see that, you know, everything is really like a dream and there's nothing solid about things, it's kind of, you know, then it doesn't matter whatever happens, I'm happy. Yeah? So I think this is what to talk about, the incorrect relative or correct relative or pure relative or impure relative, this is, I think, how it goes. I think I'll stop here, and if you have any questions, you are most welcome.
Yes, Rinpoche, if you could explain, I've heard the word in Tibetan, forget my pronunciation, namwa, which is appearance, perception, and experience. Could you explain how these relate to each other a bit?
Well, namwa is appearance. If you want to translate literally, namwa means appearance. But it could apply to all those things also, you know. What appears to me is my experience. Yeah? When I say nghe nawa, or my appearance, or appearance to me, means my experience. Yeah. So therefore, it's like that. It can apply to all those things. What is the real anything behind that?
Well, does the perception and the experience relate to each other, such as my experience and my perceptions and the appearance relating to each other, can they interrelate somehow because of my perception, the appearance has changed, or the experience has changed because of my perception?
Oh, I see. Now I can understand a little bit. You know, this, I think I tried to explain it in the beginning, you know. This is the Buddhist way of understanding is that whatever appears, whatever is there in a way, whatever appears, whatever perception is there, and has to be within my experience, yeah, or within somebody's experience. So there cannot be any appearance. That's why we call it appearance. No, there cannot be anything which is not within a certain or some experience. Yeah. So therefore, it's a sheja. You know, the word sheja. Knowable phenomena is used because everything has to be explained from an experience point of view. You cannot explain anything which is not within a certain experience, because then what is there to explain? That's the general understanding, and from there comes this, that nawa is an appearance, because it is a nawa, it's an appearance, it's appearance to some experience. Does it make sense? Yeah. So from that point of view, you know, sometimes we might feel that there is an outer world there, and then there's a perception which is product of that outer world. That's one way of looking in the world. Yeah. But from Buddhist point of view, even if you look at that, that's also a perception. That's also a perception, because it's something that somebody is perceiving. Yeah.
Rinpoche, can I ask you advice? For a long time, I have my emotional response to impermanence is sorrow and sadness, and I feel stuck in that, and I wondered if you could give some advice.
I think that's that's a common thing, because the way we relate to things, you know, we kind of look at, you know, things that perish, something bad, you know, something negative, something, you know, wrong things, you know. So death is something wrong, so therefore change is, could be better things change, but you know, usually something passing is. So this is, I think, for many people this problem. I think I think it's very important to go deeper into this and understand impermanence in a more clear and deeper way. When you say it's impermanent, it's not saying that everything has ended. It's saying that everything is the way everything exists is in this kind of a momentary way. That's the way everything exists. But you find there also something really, you know, fearless. For this, I always quote this the song from Milarepa. There's a song of Milarepa where it says that I was afraid of death and ran away into the mountains. I reflected on the uncertainty of death. I reflected on the uncertainty of death so much so that I found deathless. Now that even the death comes, I have no fear. I think it has a very deep meaning. What it's saying is, you know, that now he was afraid of death like all of us and then went into the mountains. But then what did he do there? He didn't try to hide from the death, because you cannot. Yeah. He's trying to get rid of the death, because you cannot. He reflected on the uncertainty of death, which looked even more worse, no? Yeah. I ran away from death, now I'll die tomorrow, maybe I die tonight, maybe I die tomorrow. It's not going to help, no? But it helped. How? Because when you see that impermanent is not like I'm living now, but one day I'll die, then it's very bad. It's not that. That death is happening every moment. Yeah? every moment is a change, and therefore is a kind of a death. And so therefore, it's happening all the time, and even death is like that. So when a death is happening every moment, and birth is happening every moment, what is a big deal to die? Yeah? And in a way, what is it that dies? Because what am I is momentary. So therefore, what I call me is a momentary thing that's happening, not really existing on its own anyway, and it's changing all the time, who is it that's going to die and what is it that's going to die? You know? So therefore, you know, through impermanence, he found deathlessness, because there's nothing called death in a way, there's nothing to die. So therefore, actually, in that impermanence is permanent in a way, because, you know, there's nothing there to die. Yeah? So therefore, if you go deep into the impermanence, it's very, what can you say? It's very, it's giving a kind of sense of deathlessness, fearlessness, sense of spaciousness, sense of, you know, peace, because what is there to be afraid of? There's nothing. Yeah? So this understanding is the most important thing, I think, you know. So therefore, everything is momentary, everything is, so it's not necessary to fear anything and for anything, because everything is so moving and so changing and so transcendent. So, you know, fear what? Why? There's nothing to be destroyed. So, you know, so what is there to be feared for? You know? So when understand that clearly, then there is no. So that, if you understand that way, then I think impermanence gives a very clear and very strong confidence, you know, very strong confidence. And that's actually the true understanding of impermanence.
Rinpoche, can you a little bit clarify what you mean about when you say a samsaric being is experiencing everything out there, and even so the appearances depend on the person who sees? So to put it in a quite simple question, for example, if I'm leaving this room, what's still inside here?
Okay. Of course, when you leave this room, this room doesn't become, you know, disappear. I hope so. But this is like this. I think this is has to be understood like this. We see this room as like this because we are like this. Yeah. Anybody who has this kind of body, this kind of mind, this kind of eyes will see this room in this way. Yeah. If I had a totally different body, different eye, different brain, I would probably see this room in a different way. No? Say, like, if I was as small as a cell in my body, or something like that, or insect, what you call it, bacteria in my body. I would not see this room as this room now, no? Or if I was like, I had an eye, which is like a, you know, X-ray or something like that, I wouldn't see this room as it is, no? So therefore, this room has, the way I see this room is partly because the way I am. Yeah? So in the same way, the way we see this world is the partly because the way we are. So therefore, you know, we call it a common calm. So therefore, you know, we see this room, we all see this room in a certain way, same way, but we also see certain ways different. Yeah? Sometimes people come and, oh, it's, you know, so beautiful, it's so nice, you know, so wonderful. And then some others come, oh, it's so busy, yeah, it's so frightening, you know. I've heard people going to a Tibetan monastery or something like that, and, you know, I get headache because it's so busy, they say. I don't understand this busyness because, you know, busy, why busy? Nobody is running around. But they say that, that's what they feel, yeah? And therefore, you know, you see things slightly differently, I think, but, you know, slightly same, and this is according to the way we are. So therefore, when we say that everything is, you know, is appearance, you know, as according to my experience, it's not saying that everything is, there's nothing, but what the way I experience, the way I see is partly there and partly here. But then if you look at the way things are, this is where this the Madhyamika philosophy comes in. And you look at this pillar, you know, and say, this is the pillar. Now this pillar, what is this? You know, where is the pillar? The pillar is also, you know, lots of things. And it's, you know, we put all this together in our mind and then say, this is the pillar, you know. Who is making this, what is it that's making the distinction from separating the pillarness from all others, yeah? Something has to make the separation from everything and then make pillar. Otherwise, it's all collected, no? So therefore, the way we see things is the way I see things. And then if you look deeply, then it's all, actually it's all atoms, and atoms also, you know, that the physicist will tell you how it is. So, you know, there's really, you know, it's nothing much outside the, you know, and the colors, they say it's all to do with our eyes, and isn't it, you know, how this color happens, this I think somebody will tell you. So therefore, there is lots of things that interaction and, you know, interdependent and things like that.
Okay, I have a question relating to this, actually, because I was having a talk a while ago with a woman, and we were talking about that things are atoms, and she said, like, yeah, but, and she's also like a Buddhist, the lady, and she said, but if you look through a microscope, if we had a microscope that could see atoms, there are atoms. And then I thought, but if you get somebody out of the jungle in the Amazons who is completely differently cultural conditioned and who kind of say believes that everything exists out of very small blue dwarfs, little blue people. When he looks through the microscope, does he see blue people instead of atoms? And does somehow I, in my mind, always give more value to it being an atom than, for example, a blue dwarf? So whatever I perceive, somehow I think that's more real. So is it true that is the atom, or is it just a cultural conditioning, like because we have a scientific mind and all that? And if so, how do I overcome that problem of giving more value to my cultural and whatever conditionings than to other possible perception?
You know, whatever, I think this is something, you know, cultural perceptions sometimes can be very funny. I think the more, yeah, sometimes people probably see it according to their, you know, cultural perception also, you know, and sometimes very, very strongly, you know, very strongly and very, very deeply. And I see this. Like I sometimes have this in the conferences with the different religious groups, you know, things like that. And those who believe in God, for instance, everything becomes a proof of the existence of God. Everything. Those that I see as the proof of not having a God, for them becomes as proof to existence of God. Yeah. So I think it's a lot to do with that kind of, you know, the way you see things. It's, I think, because, you know, it's the same thing that if your mind is set in a certain way, then you can see it like that, because that's where you're, you know, like, because there's nothing like this is it exactly. It's possible that somebody sees blue people and, you know, even if you say it's not blue people, they insist it's blue people because I say it's possible. I don't know, but it's like that. But when you look into the X-ray, you know, not X-ray, yeah, X-ray, I think, or whatever, I don't know. Like once I had a blood check, and this doctor, you know, put one kind of, one little drop of blood on many, glasses. And then one of them put under the microscope. And then it came on the TV screen. And on that, you know, not even one drop, you know, a little bit, that's also dry, you know. It looks like a whole universe, you know. There's big ones coming, and then the small ones there, you know. It's big ones even eat the small ones, you know, on that, you know. And then these round ones, and then there's the long ones, and, you know, it looks really like, you know, the cosmos, you know. That's just one little drop of my blood, you know. So it's like that. It's very, you know, the deeper you go, it's still like a universe, you know, even a little bit like universe. And so therefore, you know, everything is, and there's so much space there, yeah? Even within this little one drop of, there's like a universe, yeah? If you look from that point of view. So therefore there's, you know, it's absolutely possible, I think, to have a whole universe here, yeah? Or on speck of dust, you know, then what do you say? That's existing on its own? Yeah, it's existing on its own in a way. And people in there will see everything as really real, I think, yeah? Because everything is, in a way, made of lots of things, but in a way, made of almost nothing. So that's the Buddhist way of understanding. So it's a small thing is a small thing from one perspective, but it's not a small thing from another perspective. It could be a whole, if you go into it, it could be a whole universe. Yeah. So therefore, it's that's why it's relative.